there's a lot of talk about demons in that first paragraph. I was wondering if the Rook could tell us how the Rambam learned those particular passages.
Well, you know, it's unfortunate that the Rambam promised to tell us and he wasn't able to keep that promise. And basically, as you know, there is in Sefer Brachos in particular a lot of statements about Shadim, and then in Sifrei Kabbalah there's many, many statements about Shadim, and some of them are connected to Adam HaRishon, that for 130 years after the death of Chayim he was separated from his wife, and there may have been Zara Levatala that created Shadim and the like. And it's interesting that in the Talmud Yerushalmi there is no Gemaras about Shadim. It's only in the Talmud Bavli, it's not in the Talmud Yerushalmi. And there is a big machlokas. The Rambam is well known as saying there is no such thing as Shadim. But he says that when Chazal speak about these mazikim or Shadim, these are metaphors or mishalim for deeper spiritual truths that Chazal are simply using popular language to describe some very, very deep ideas. And the Rambam promises us he's going to write an explanation on these agadas that is going to tell us what these ideas were. But in the Mor Nebuchim, the Rambam says he changed his mind. He decided not to write it because he said that if Chazal wanted to cover up the inner meaning, he was not going to reveal the inner meaning. Now, it's also yidua that the Vilna Gaon, the Bir Hagra de Shulchan Aruch, says that the Rambam was led astray by his preoccupation with Greek philosophy. The Rambam, the Gra calls it Philosophia Ha'arura, which really created a certain rationalistic mindset which could not accept anything that could not be explained by human reason. And the Gra says, Feirish, that if Chazal talk about Shadim, then certainly there are Shadim. Now, it's a machlokes. I can't tell you what the answer is. I mean, somebody has to Kutzker Rebbe. Is the halacha like the Rambam or the Gras? So the Kutzker Rebbe said, for sure, if the Gras says, the Gras says there are Shadim, there are Shadim. So he then, so the person then asked him, so how come we don't see Shadim, we don't encounter Shadim today? So he says, once the Rambam paskin, they don't exist, even the Shadim have to respect the Rambam. This is what is really funny. So, you know, I can't tell you. I mean, even to this very day, there are people who take off Ayin Horus and this and that. For Ayin Horus, might be a different area, but it's connected to the idea of Shadim and Mazikim. So this is an important point, though, that the Maharal makes. Maharal makes, when it comes to Agadita, he says there are really two extreme schools of thought, and both of them are mistaken, the Maharal says. One school of thought says all Agada is true, and it must be taken true in a literal sense, no matter how strange and extreme it sounds. The other Shita says all Agada is stated literally, and therefore it's false if it doesn't make sense. Both of them are interpreting the statement literally, and some people say absolutely true, and some people say absolutely false. It's a Baba Maisa. The Maharal says the appropriate idea is that everything Chazal say is 100% true. 100% true. But the truth is, in Agadata, is not always a literal truth. It is a symbolic truth. Chazal utilize symbolic language to communicate spiritual truth. So the Agada is emes, no matter how strange it is, but the emes of the Agada is not always what it says literally on the surface. Vissal Solanter gave a mashal, a simple mashal, to illustrate this. You know, Vissal Solanter lived in the middle of the 19th century, the last third of the 19th century, and in Russia at the time, Jews were confined to only certain areas of the country. They could not live largely in big cities. This is the shteplich, it's called the Pale of Settlement. And the problem is that the czars were always redrawing the map, so it might be very common, you know, every 6 months, Jews just had to leave the district and go somewhere else. So Vissal Solanter said, imagine the czar decrees that 100,000 Jews have to leave by the end of the week. So if you were a journalist with a very colorful language, you could write it in the newspaper, with a drop of ink, 100,000 people drowned, meaning the czar signing a signature on a piece of paper, destroyed 100,000 people. Now, let's say 200 years later you find that newspaper, and the newspaper says, a drop of ink drowned 100,000 people. You're going to say, what type of Baba Mice is this? It was a giant who had the ink, you know, and the people are midgets. But if you understood the situation, you would see what a vivid metaphorical way this is being described. Now, God is that way, Rabbi Sosa Lantry says. Sometimes it is as simple a matter as understanding the historical events of the time in which Chazal were talking about. And most of the time, it might be a deeper process of trying to understand the religious and philosophical issues. Now, a very outstanding example that you might look at, you may have the book, I'm sure it's around here, The Juggler and the King. The Juggler and the King is a translation or an adaptation by Rav Aaron Feldman, the Rosh of Mary Israel, who used to be kind of the highest shear in Or Sameach for many years. And he takes from the Vilna Gaon a series of explanations on Agadata in the fifth parak of Levi Basra. And that Agadata is the Rabba Bar Barchana story. Rabba Barchana was an Amora, and he has stories that are kind of like Lahavdil, like Paul Bunyan stories, about giant birds and fish and things that superficially seem very, very bizarre, very strange, and almost impossible. And the Vilna Gaon shows how these are poetic and metaphorical ways of expressing very, very deep spiritual truths, much of which is Kabbalistic, but Rav Aaron Feldman gives you at least an adaptation of the surface level of the Pshat. So that's a very it's a very good book to look at to get a sense of the symbolic language of Agadita. And the Maharal's hold, the Maharal wrote 20, over 20 Svarim, and although they're on different themes, the Tzad HaShaveh of all the Maharal Svarim are to kind of open up the symbolic meaning of Agadita. So all I can tell you is that how the Rambam will learn, you know, we don't know, because he told us he was going to write the book and did not.
Can you explain
Mashiach and Yosef? Yeah, right, you mentioned that. Yeah, Mashiach and Yosef. So the truth is, Mashiach and Yosef is a very enigmatic fellow. He's only mentioned in the Shas Bavli only once, and it's interesting. He is mentioned in connection with the halachic source for the law of mechitza of all things, right? It mentions in Masechet Sukkah, and many of you may have learned that Gemara, that during the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, the ceremony of the water drawing, they would build in the courtyard of the temple, the Ezras Nashim, they would build a balcony, and women would be on the balcony so they shouldn't mix with men. And this was called a tikkun gadol, this was called a great, great improvement, because it guaranteed snias at a time of joy. Now then the Gemara says, how do we know men and women are supposed to be separate? Because there's a pasuk in Zechariah that says that there'll be, blessed love by some great tragedy, it doesn't say what it is, and the men will be crying and the women will be crying, and the implication is they're mourning in two different places. And the Gemara says, a kal v'chomer, if even at a funeral where people are so serious and somber, men and women are supposed to be separate, kal v'chomer at a time of joy. The Gemara then says, what is the great tragedy for which men and women are going to be mourning? And it says it will be the death of Mashiach ben Yosef. And that's really all we know. Now, the basic idea is this. We are told that just like the Jewish people were ruled over Yosef, because Yosef was the king in Mitzrayim, and that was a preparation for there to be Malchus based David of Yehuda and the like, David of Malch Yehuda, so too in the future redemption, there will first be a redeemer from the house of Yosef, and his goal will be to destroy Amalek, destroy the kaychais of evil in the world, paving the way for the ultimate redemption of Mashiach ben David. But Mashiach ben Yosef will be successful, but he will die, meaning he will accomplish his mission, but he will die. Now, there are a lot of questions here. First of all, the idea that you need a Yosef as a precursor goes back to a Gemara in Bava Basra. The Gemara in Bava Basra says, Amalek can only be defeated by the children of Rachel and not the children of Leah. It is only the children of Rachel. By the way, tonight, this is the Yahrzeit of Rachel Imenu tonight. So it's interesting that your question brings up this Gemara. There's always a Hashkacha. Huh? Is it tomorrow night? Oh, today already. Today. Okay, so we're missing. Okay. Well, we're leaving. Okay, we just had the yard sale. And so Amalek can be eradicated only by Zerah, Rachel, and not Leah. Why is that so? There are different reasons. Amalek comes from Esav, Esav represents hatred, sinas chinam against Am Yisrael, even though we're brothers. So all of the brothers who participated in Mechiras Yosef are guilty of sinas chinam, so they don't have the koach to go against Amalek. It's only Rachel who, number one, showed love to her sister Leah, and also Rachel's children. Yosef was a victim, and Binyamin did not participate in the Mechira. So the children of Rachel are free from the taint of sinas chinam, and therefore they can defeat Amalek that represents sinas chinam. This is why in the Midbar, and this is a pattern you see throughout history, in the desert, the leader of the war against Amalek was Yehoshua ben Nun from the tribe of Ephraim, which is Yosef. You see that before there could be a David HaMelech, there had to be a Shaul HaMelech, who is from Binyamin, the child of Rachel. And it was Shaul that was given the command to eradicate Amalek. And when he spared the king, unfortunately, that resulted in Haman. And in the time of Purim, it was Mordechai and Esther from the tribe of Binyamin who could defeat Amalek. Now, sometimes it's Binyamin, sometimes it's Yosef. But the Tzad HaShaveh is that it's Rachel. And therefore, before Mashiach ben David can come, Mashiach ben Yosef must destroy those powers of evil. Now, the thing is this. Why is sometimes Yosef, sometimes Binyamin? We don't always know, but it's always going to be from Rachel that Amalek gets destroyed, and therefore God's name becomes whole. Hashem's name cannot be whole as long as Amalek is in the world. Now, one thing that's a little problematical is we're not really sure if Moshiach ben Yosef reveals himself. The Gemara in Sukkah implies yes, because people will mourn over him. Or he might just be somebody, maybe he was some American private who was fighting the Nazis in World War II. In other words, he was involved in the eradication of Amalek, but was not necessarily a public person. There is also a teaching of the Vilna Gaon. There's a sefer from one of the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon, which are the teachings of the Vilna Gaon on redemption and on Geula. It is called Kol HaTor. Kol HaTor means the voice of the turtle dove. It's based on a verse in Shir HaShirim. The Sefer is a bit controversial. There are those that claim it was a forgery, and they say it is not the teaching of the Vilna Gaon because it's both pro-Zionistic in some ways, and it's pro-secular studies, and they say the Vilna Gaon could not possibly have had that shita. On the other hand, as great a person as Rav Chaim Friedlander, a very, very great tzaddik in Talmud Chacham, he said it was an authentic sefer, and you can get Kol HaTor. You could actually get it. It's hard to understand. It's kind of a Kabbalistic work in many levels. But the Kol HaTor brings, in the name of the Vilna Gaon, that Mashiach ben Yosef is a person, but it also represents an ideal. And the ideal is that before the miraculous Mashiach ben David comes, Mashiach ben Yosef is preparing Eretz Yisrael in what is called Bederech HaTeva, by bringing Jews back, by building up a society. You know, this is where I mentioned it's Zionistic in that sense, where he talks about the fact that the physical as well as the spiritual building of Eretz Yisrael is a precursor to Mashiach ben David, because that practical religious Zionistic impulse represents the Mashiach ben Yosef part of the Geula. And the Vilna Gaon says, if we do it properly, we can avoid the Mashiach ben Yosef actually being killed. Meaning, that's plan B. That does not have to be the way the redemption comes. Now, that is why, if you know historically, the Talmidim of the Gra, by the way, it's recorded in that Sefer, that the reason that the Gra wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael, as is well known, but he turned back. He didn't make it. In the Sefer, it is recorded, beautiful idea, and they prove it with Gematrius, that the Vilna Gaon was a Gilgal of Moshe Rabbeinu. Which, you know, if anyone was a Gilgal, that makes sense. He was a reincarnation of Moshe Rabbeinu, and therefore the same way it was decreed that Moshe Rabbeinu could not enter Eretz Yisrael, it was decreed that the Vilna Gaon could not enter Eretz Yisrael, but the Talmidim of the Gra, like Yehoshua ben Nun, who received the Messiah from their Rebbe, and they were able to enter. But be it as it may, the Talmidei HaGra, as you know, are really the founders of the Ashkenazic, Svartim we heard earlier, the Ashkenazic settlement of religious people in Eretz Yisrael. That's why so many of our minhagim are minhagei HaGra, right? You hear these things, because the Gra was miyasin in Yerushalayim, the Talmidei Agra were miyaseh all of these minhagim. But if you know, they physically built many of the settlements outside of the walls of the old city. So places like Mea Sharim, which of course is still very religious, Nachal HaShiva, which is not so religious, but there was Nachal HaShiva, different neighborhoods. It wasn't just they came here and they learned. Of course they came here and they learned, but they carried the bricks. And the reason they did so is because they very much were connected to that teaching, that it is the physical building of Eretz Yisrael that represents the Moshiach ben Yosef aspect of the Geula. This is called Geula b'derech hateva. This is the naturalistic building that is needed in order to bring the spiritual growth of Mashiach. Rav Kook, very much, remember, Rav Kook came from the Volozhiner Yeshiva. Rav Kook was a Talmud of the Netziv. The Netziv married the granddaughter of Rav Chaim Volozhin. Rav Chaim Volozhiner was of course, the Talmud Mufak of the Vilna Gaon. So these teachings were very, very strong in Lithuania. Now, some of them became secular Zionists as a result, but those who remained religious, they did have this idea that it is the physical settlement of Eretz Israel, as well as, of course, the Torah and the mitzvahs that will bring the Gula. That's right, and it saved himself was very involved. Now, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who was the co-Rosh Hashiva of Volozhin, and he married the Nesiv's granddaughter, he was not. He considered any participation with Zionism as kafira, apikorsis. This was a big, big machlokas between the Nesiv and Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. To this very day, the briskers are that way, as to how one viewed the Zionist enterprise. The Nesiv viewed it very positively, and the Netziv was willing to work even with non-religious Zionists, although obviously his goal was to create Emuna and Torah. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik held you could not be mishtatef at all with Apikorsim and Kofrim and the like. So I'm not here to be machria, but all I'm saying is that this is why the Sefer Kol HaTorah was so controversial, because of the Zionist implications, not the favorite, the Zionist implications of the book. The other part that was controversial, as I indicated, is that there's a famous quote in that Sefer that you see brought down in other places, that the Vilna Gaon says, any aspect of secular wisdom that you don't know will mean it will be a tenfold diminution in your knowledge of Torah. And therefore, a Talmud Chacham has to know mathematics and science and medicine and all of these things. Once again, there were people who said, that is an absolute forgery, it's not possible that Vilna Gaon said that. But okay, be it as it may, it is a quote that Rav Chaim Friedlander says was not that.
Vilna Gaon wrote a book on geometry. So.
Yeah, right, that's correct. He had Euclid's Elements translated and the like. So that's kind of what we know about Mashiach ben Yosef. And that's not a tremendous amount. Yeah.
Because I know a lot of the Kabbalists speak about it. Vilna Gaon was a Kabbalist, so do they go along his line? Or is there
no, his line is pretty unique. I think, again, I'm not an absolute expert, but most of the Makoros do talk about a person who will be killed. The Vilna Gaon was Mechadesh, that there's a process of redemption that can circumvent a lot of that destruction, and that is the Geula b'derech hateva. That's kind of the Vilna Gaon's Chiddush. Yeah.
Maybe you can talk about even a prophecy that is for bad does not necessarily have to take place. So this may be something tantamount. Things have to unfold. God is so good. Tov Hashem Rakol, he's so good. So it doesn't necessarily have to be that the Mashiach ben Yosef has to die.
Yeah, that is a good point. In fact,
right.
In fact, apart from the Mashiach ben Yosef, even putting aside Mashiach ben Yosef, Chazal certainly talk about Chavlei Mashiach, the birth pains of Mashiach. The Nevi'im talk about the awesome wars of Gog Magog. In fact, Mashiach ben Yosef is supposed to get killed in the wars of Gog and Magog. That's exactly the connection. And yet, we do find that with tshuva and masim tovim, it is possible to either bypass the Chavlei Mashiach or have it truncated, meaning if we're supposed to have worse, at least we could be yaitzeh with what we have. It's like in prison, the judge can sometimes tell you, time served will be enough. You don't have to serve any more time. So at any point, Hashem knows we've suffered a lot, Holocaust and everything else, but Hashem can say, this is the end. In other words, it's time for the Geula. Now, one thing about this, There is something in the Gra's writings, and I wish I could find it. I have not been able to find it. I've seen it quoted in other Svarim, where the Gra writes somewhere that the war of Gog and Magog will last 9 minutes. This often awful war of Gog and Magog in the first 250 years. People read that statement, you know, that it didn't make any sense. What type of war could last for 9 minutes? Unfortunately, in our day and age, we know exactly what that might mean. So that's a very, 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 very frightening statement.
Huh? You know, David Cohn, yeah, was the rabbi, the brilliant, brilliant person who became Rosh Hashiv in Chevron.
Oh, in Chevron,
yeah. He's an expert,
yeah,
on the Vilna Gaon, and maybe the rabbi,
yeah,
wants to go to him.
Okay, I should ask him. Yeah, I should ask him about that. But according to that, Gog and Magog is referring to a nuclear war. But once again, through Tshuva and Masim Tovim, we could bypass that and not have that.
Is the Gior Bill against Halacha?
You know, you have to remind me. The Gior Bill just says that local rabbis can do Geirus. Well, what is the Gior?
I think that's the big difference.
Yeah, I have not. Each city rabbi makes his own decision.
Yeah, like they're not maybe an entirely hefker, but every city now can do it.
Okay. Okay. Well, listen. It's not again, if you go back to the United States for a moment, in the United States, you know, there is no rabbanut, there is no central organization of rabbis, and every Orthodox rabbi, theoretically, halachically, has the right to convene a beis din and determine who is accepting the commandments, and nobody above him can tell him what to do, theoretically. Now, practically, there are Rabbinical Council of America, and they have these Geirus standards, etc. But halachically, every Rav does have the right to be Eisek in Geirus. So essentially, the Gior Bill wants to create for Israel, Eretz Israel, the exact situation that did exist in America. So if you're telling me, is it against halacha, it's not intrinsically against halacha, because halacha does not require that Geirus be centralized. And in fact, there are a lot of chasronos in centralization of Geirus. I mean, I'll tell you a chisorin, that is, when you centralize something, that takes away sometimes the ability of the Rav to make individualized determinations. For example, a centralized procedure will tend to say every candidate has to have X number of months or years of preparation. Every candidate has to read, you know, these books, standardized curriculum. Well, maybe that's a good idea, but on the other hand, sometimes it doesn't make sense. Sometimes you can have a person, let's say, whose father was Jewish, whose mother was not Jewish, but the person was very interested in Judaism, the person knows how to read Hebrew, the person has been learning Chumash and Mishnah and Gemara, you know, for 10 years. And now he comes and he realizes, halachically I'm not Jewish, even though the Reform Movement says I was. So what? I'm going to make the person, you know, take a course in Aleph Beis? You know, in other words, the point of decentralization is that it allows individual determinations. You know, when I used to be in the Geirus business, and I'm not in that business anymore. Well, I was never in the business, but I myself did quite a lot of Geirus over 20, 23 years in Rabbanus. There were people that I refused to convert. There were people that I worked with for 2 years. And there were people that I converted, you know, in 6 hours after they came to me. I mean, you know, there were people, they were living as from, but there was some technical problem in what they had gone through. So what's the big deal? Someone is keeping Shabbos, someone is keeping Kashrus, Taras and Mishpacha, they enrolled their kids in a day school. What am I holding it up? You know, now, when you have a centralized conversion rule, you know, everybody got to go through the 2 years, everybody has to take the Aleph Beis course, you know, everybody has to do that. So that's the chisaron. Now, what is the maila? The maila is a very important maila. And that is, when you leave it to individual rabbis, then unfortunately, different rabbis have different standards. The halacha is very clear that a geirus is, well, it's not 100% clear, but basically, it's the psak is pretty much established that a geirus is not valid even b'di'evit. And I'm not going to deny that there are machlokim in this, but the halacha, a geirus is not valid unless the candidate is committed to keep the mitzvos, as explained by not only the Torah Shebichtav, but the Torah Shebal Peh and the Shulchan Aruch. Now, some rabbis know this, but they don't necessarily ask a lot of questions. So somebody says, are you going to keep Shabbos? And the candidate says, well, you know, I'll do it to the best of my ability. The rabbi doesn't want to ask any further. There are rabbis who are under pressures to convert because the girl is marrying, you know, some rich member of the
president's daughter.
What's the rabbi supposed to do? Some rabbis have lost their job over this. Other rabbis, you know, need to keep their job, and they've been. So the notion of centralization, number one, does create standards, and it also gives individual rabbis a defense or a cover, because the individual rabbi can say, it's not me, it's the RCA that says I got it. In other words, the rabbi can kind of blame an organization, which can give him cover. Now, in Eretz Yisrael, it's really the same thing. Although, Baruch Hashem, I would hope that the vast majority of rabbanim are honest and conscientious, and they care about Kabbalah's mitzvahs, but sometimes there are scandals. Now, of course, I have to say that even with the rabbanut system, there are scandals. I mean, it's not the pshat. In other words, the rabbanut is kind of making a little bit of a, I don't want to say hypocritical argument. The rabbanut is saying, hey, if you take gerus away from the rabbanut and you leave it to local rabbis, who knows what the local rabbis are going to do? Right? That's what they say. Well, I'll say, who knows what the rabbanut has done? You know, with Russian conversions, so many of whom, you know, don't keep any commandments at all. There was a classic commercial. It was an unfair commercial, but it was very, very funny about...
With the fax machine.
Yeah, a great commercial. Although, again, I mean, it was offensive, and it may not have been proper, because there are certainly sincere gayrim from the Russian community, or tzaddikim and the like, but they made a joke about the woman standing under the chuppah, and she, you know, she gets her gayrus from the fax machine, you know, Gior, and the like. And some of them are like that. There are some American, I think it was an American black guy who wanted to play basketball. He didn't make the NBA, so he wanted to play basketball in Israel. But apparently, in order to play, he had to be a citizen. In order to be a citizen, he had to be Jewish. So he got himself a gay, you know. So the truth of the matter is, it's not like the Rabbanut system is such a wonderful system. Right? Maybe it gets better. Maybe it depends who the Rabbanim are. Now the Rabbanim are, you know, etc. But the Rabbanut is afraid that if you leave it to individual rabbis, we're just not going to know every single conversion. You know, is it good? Is it not good? So I can't say it's against halacha, but I do understand that it's not a good idea, because it could introduce questionable people into Klal Yisrael, and that's a dangerous thing. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm not sure the phrase exactly. What is the basis for the seeming 100% support for the Republican Party amongst the Haredi population at large?
You said one in the United States?
In the U.S., obviously.
In the U.S., yeah.
It's
yeah.
appropriate considering tonight's the election.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. Well, I'm not sure if it's 100%. I mean, listen, the thing is this. The thing is that, you know, we talk about Democrats are called blue states and Republicans are red states. As I would say, Hashem is not a blue or red, meaning HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a Torah, and the Jew is supposed to try to follow the Torah. Now, it happens to be that the Democratic Party's positions on many, many moral issues are very antagonistic to Ruchnius. Number one, the Democratic Party is very much in favor of abortion on demand, the woman's right to choose. The Democratic Party is committed to gay marriage and the like. So, Mimele, if I'm a religious Jew and I would like a government that follows the values of the Torah, then I might not gravitate.
Even for
non-Jews. I should also say as well that although officially the Democratic Party is not anti-Israel per se, but for some reason, and you have to study why it's hard, I'll tell you, people who are in the left politically and morally tend to somehow look at Israel as a racist, evil state. So I would say that the primary problem is the morality of the positions of the spouse, plus the very, very strong anti-Israel bias, equating Israel to Nazism and apartheid. Republicans are a little better in that way. Now, le'idach gisa, you should know that for many, many, many years, really going back to Franklin Roosevelt, not that many years ago. Now, although Roosevelt himself was very controversial in terms of what he did not do for Jews in Europe during the Holocaust, but many, many Jews, I mean, anyone that had parents or grandparents in America, they were probably Democratic. And that is because, you know, Roosevelt, the Democratic Party, was very generous in terms of social welfare, in terms of building people up. They had more rachmanis. So in a sense, you could say that in terms of tztaka v'chesed, The Democratic Party tended to be better, but in recent years, the Democratic Party has gotten more radical and immoral, and that's why people go with Republican. But the MS is, as I say, you know, Henry Kissinger once said about the Iran-Iraq war, he said, he says, the real pity of it is that somebody has to win, he said. It would be nice if they would both just... So the truth of the matter is, you know, you can't say the Democratic Party is totally kosher and the Republican Party is not totally kosher. You know, there are bits and pieces, and mainly you have to work with individual candidates and see. Now, one interesting shaila that one can ask themselves in terms of politics, and I don't want to give a whole speech on politics, is do I vote the issues or do I vote the person? For example, let's say I have a candidate who's an immoral guy, he commits adultery, he does all sorts of things, but he happens to be strongly pro-Israel, and he'll get a lot of money for my needs, let's say for the things that I think are important, but as a person, he's not a good person. Then I have another candidate, let's say, who's a fundamentalist Christian, so he's very, very moral, very, et cetera, but he has positions that are connected to me. So do I say, better to vote for the more righteous person, even though it's against my selfish interests, or not even my selfish, even against the Jewish interests, or is it better to vote for the one that supports Israel more, or the like? You know, it is a good question. Do you vote the person or the issues? I think that this was an issue, I think, in one of the New York elections, I'm not sure, I think one of the candidates who was for aid for yeshivas and for Eretz Israel happened to be gay or something. There was some issue like that. So he was getting endorsements from Rosh Yeshivas, and he was getting endorsements from Rabbanim, and some people were saying, what, you're endorsing an openly gay guy? That's a good shot. I don't have a clear stock in that, but that would be something to think about. But that's why.
The Gators thing, yeah. I was going to say, yeah. If someone comes in 1991, they opened it up in 1990-91, that if someone, they accepted reform conversions,
yeah,
or conservative or reconstructionist,
yeah,
then you have rights for citizenship in Israel. Once, and I know someone who came here, a woman, and once she was a citizen, they did a Tikkun Geiris in 4.5 months. They did,
yeah,
a repair Geiris on it. She had some good backing. She was studying with someone, and all that. But they didn't,
yeah,
know that she was a missionary. But whatever.
Yeah.
But they do. But anyone who comes, that's the way into the land. Once you're here, you do Tikkun Geiris, a repair,
yeah,
that you go through the Rabbanut.
Yeah.
The,
yeah,
problem. The problem is the motive that I see in the newspaper. But this way, we can get more and more conversions. No,
right,
they have 4 conversion places, the chief rabbinate, which we should respect them, and they don't want to accept with the Knesset path.
Yeah.
So give them more dayanim, open them up, but they should be in control,
yeah,
because you have the private rabbis in the towns. Someone can go to a particular town,
yeah,
they know one rabbi did many, many gayers,
yeah,
hundreds of them, and he didn't, yeah, even signed on documents that he wasn't around.
Yeah, there are people who do it for the money. There are people who do it for the money. I mean, both in the States and in Eretz Israel as well, so you have to be very careful. Contrast is the same issue. You know it is against the law in Israel for any kosher establishment not to have a rabbanut hashgacha. So even if something is Eda Charedis, it has to have a rabbanut as well, because if I can open up my private hashgacha, you know, I'll just, in fact, there are people who just, they get a fancy sign, a fancy tudah that's printed with gold border and whatever it is, and they say, Mahadrin, whatever it is. And, you know, the whole thing is made up. You know, they could sell bacon there, you know, whatever it would be. Yeah.
Can we discuss why it's a mitzvah to burn a book written by an Api Koras, a Jewish Api Koras, and
yeah,
why this even extends to the Rite of Sefer Torah, and if this applies in any way today?
Yeah, so you have to burn your jastro. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, the idea is like this. You are correct that the Gemara says quite literally that a sefer that is written by an apikoros, even a sefer Torah that has Hashem's name in it, you destroy. There are two ideas there that are related. One idea is simply that we don't want to give the apikoros legitimacy and acceptability, because if I could point in my shul and say, oh, this sefer Torah was written by the famous apikoros, so people can say, he must be someone that we can pay attention to. So they're not only going to read his Torah, they're going to read his book. So in an indirect way, you're giving the apikoros influence by validating the things that he did. That's one aspect. Another aspect is more of a almost Kabbalistic, mystical idea, and that is people put their personalities into what they do. You've heard this by music, I think. People say, you know, you shouldn't listen to music, even certain types of music, because the person who has degenerate or improper kavanot puts them into the music and it affects you. So too, if the apikoros is writing the Torah and he's thinking about, he doesn't believe in God, etc., that affects, you know, the holiness and the spiritual vibes. Now that's a mystical idea, because textually it's the same Sefer Torah, but we do get affected by the author of those words, or the, at least the inscriber of those words. Now, does it apply today? It does apply today, but the question is, you don't see that many book burnings. You see a few once in a while, but not too many. I mean, part of it is.
It's counterproductive, because you're burning someone else's book, that's going to burn your book. It's
no, that's correct. And also,
it's very popular to some people. This book was burned.
Yes, that's correct. In other words, book burning actually increases popularity. There's no question. I think I mentioned last week or the week before that years ago, the Lakewood Cheder sent out a biography of the Nisiv that was written by the Torah Tamima. And a few weeks later, we got a letter, please send back the book and we'll give you a refund. And at that point, everybody who didn't bother to read the book certainly read the book at that point, because they were so curious. The issue was because that biography said the Nisiv was in favor of secular studies and religion and whatever. And that wasn't, people said that wasn't the case. Okay, whatever.
My uncle the Nisiv.
So in many ways, the book burning doesn't work today, because it's going to make the book, of course, it's more popular rather than less popular. Now, coming to Jastrow, I mean, no one's going to tell you to burn a Jastrow today. Jastrow, of course, if you didn't know, was a very, very, he was an academic, he was a professor, but he was also a very prominent Reform rabbi in the early 20th century of the United States. So some people have brought up the argument, hey, are you allowed to use Jastrow? You know, it was written by a non-religious guy. Dictionary is a little different. If you would have read Jastrow's commentary in the Talmud, that would have been, you know, a bit more problematical. His commentary on the Chumash, you know, I would tell you not to get. Dictionary is a dictionary. Although it's fascinating, I don't know if you ever read Jastrow's introduction to his dictionary. There's one line there that, you know, it's a little bit of an attack on the yeshivas. He says, we will never really understand, you know, the meaning of the Talmud until the people who are too involved in its doctrinal aspects will focus on its linguistic aspects. In other words, he's basically saying, you know, learn Gemara to know what the words mean and not, you know, not the ideas. The people are spending too much time on the ideas of the Talmud, not enough on the words. That's a direct attack on yeshiva learning. But that's the idea. The idea of burning it is, number one, to prevent influence in other areas, and number two, to avoid spiritual emanations from his own writing.
I want to know if you can, in a nutshell, I don't really have a lot of time, but in regards to evolution and like dinosaurs, what's the nutshell perspective of Judaism on that?
Yeah, I'll give you a one-sentence answer, but I will. Please remember to ask me next week, because I want to give you a longer answer on it. The short answer is that different rabbis, different gedolim will say different things. I will tell you this. An approach, which many have taken, is that the Torah, Chazal, accommodate many, many different types of scientific theories, and one cannot say that any theory is ruled out by our Messiah. The lesson of Bereishis is there's a Ribono Shel Olam, he created the world. Everything comes from him. However, the Ribono Shel Olam has infinite tools in his palette, and the Ribono Shel Olam can use all sorts of ways to create the world. There could be evolution, there could be this and that. As long as you don't believe it is random, chaotic, and undirected, you are within the framework of Messiah. Now, this is what I'm telling you. There are those who say not. And obviously, those who say that the Torah could support these different theories do have to deal with how do you understand the Pesukim in Bereishis, etc., which seems to say not that way. But let me just say that already we find in the Ramban and in other Rishonim, and going back to the Rambam as well, that the Seder of Bereishis cannot be understood literally. It is a sod, and the Torah deliberately is not giving you all the details. So in a sense, I don't think there's any conflict of science and religion and Torah, because science tells you how the world was created, Torah tells you why the world was created, and as long as you have the why, then how could be anything. You know, my nafkamina could be this, could be that. But we'll talk a little more about Rishis next time.